you are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Just try to define Arianna Huffington. The facts will defy you. Born in Greece, educated at Cambridge, she's now a prominent political commentator and syndicated columnist in America. In the mid-1990s, she was famously on board Newt Gingrich's Contract with America bandwagon, then moved out big time in the late 90s to embrace a liberal line. In this hour, Arianna Huffington's migration and the map of American politics today. We begin the program with a story from Norway. Just days after the call went out, a conservative Norwegian parliamentarian has nominated President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair jointly for the Nobel Peace Prize for their tough intolerance of terror. Erwin Abrams is professor emeritus at Antioch University and author of The Nobel Peace Prize and the Laureates. Earlier, I asked him about the field of competition Bush and Blair might be facing for this year's honor.
Names are never mentioned. They were. There was a period in the 100 years when they were mentioned, those who were nominated. But the committee does not release the names. They only say the number. The highest number in the last few years has been 150 nominees. That means individuals and organizations, institutions. And the people who are eligible to nominate, there are several categories. I'm able to nominate because university professors of history, political science, law, and philosophy may nominate. Many nominations come through members of legislatures, Congress in our case, and also governments. Past winners may nominate. Also, members of the International Peace Bureau, main committee, which brings in the peace activists, and the International Law Institute, which brings in international lawyers. Also the arbitration court, the court in The Hague. And then if somebody nominates himself or herself, that is immediately discarded. You may not nominate yourself.
So this is one prize you can't write in your own name for.
No, that's right.
Now, once the nominees are given, who picks the ultimate winner, and what do they tend to look for as characteristics of a Nobel Peace Prize winner?
Well, what they should be looking for, according to Nobel's will, he spoke of those who were doing a benefit for humanity. That's all his prizes, including peace, which is Norway. The other prizes are all Sweden. And what he said in one clause was those who are working for fraternity among peoples, which the Nobel Committee already in 1901, the first year of the prize, expanded to mean a variety of possibilities, including most recently champions of human rights, because they feel that peace must be based upon justice. That's the most recent, within the last 25 years, expansion of the award. Under that category, an American named Norman Borlaug got the prize, who was an agricultural scientist, because as the father of the Green Revolution, as he's been called, he saw to it that more food was produced for the world, and you can't have peace based on hungry people. So that might seem a most far-reaching interpretation of peace, but it's very logical that peace has to be based upon enough to eat.
Of course, Albert Schweitzer won it in 1952, George Marshall in 53, Andrei Sakharov, Mother Teresa, Anwar Sadat, even Henry Kissinger and Lee Duc Tho for negotiating the Vietnam Peace Accord in 1973.
Well, that was an armistice, and it didn't work. And so, first of all, Lee Duc Tho refused to accept the prize. He said that the United States was violating the terms of the armistice, and Henry Kissinger said that the North Vietnamese were violating, but he accepted the prize. But then after the North Vietnamese defeated the South Vietnamese, Kissinger said he wanted to give back his prize. And then the committee told him that you can't do that according to the statutes.
It's a one-way deal.
It's a one-way deal.
So the one category I haven't heard, we're told to anticipate any number of nominations growing out of September 11th. We're told to expect a nomination for Rudy Giuliani, even for the engineer who designed the World Trade Center. Is this a new approach that people who have dealt with suffering would be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize?
If you're thinking of the humanitarians who worked with those who are suffering, you think, of course, of Mother Teresa. And you think of, well, the very first prize given to the founder of the Red Cross, that's a suffering due to war, and this has been called a war by President Bush. So I guess the category of human suffering would be answered then by humanitarians, like the ones that we've talked about. And you mentioned Mother Teresa, and the Doctors Without Borders are the most recent winners of for humanitarian service. And they also, as it turns out, have said that they want to defend human rights in the work they do for humanitarian purposes in medical relief and all. And so in an interesting way, they combine the two purposes of the prize that's gone on through the years. The humanitarian one signaled in 1901 with the Red Cross founder, Henri Dunant, and then the doctors who work for humanitarian purposes, but also with human rights incentives.
Irwin Abrams, if you had to estimate the odds of George Bush and Tony Blair winning the Peace Prize when it comes out in October this year, what do you reckon? How would you lay the odds?
Oh, well, very, very long shot. I wouldn't expect this at all.
Irwin Abrams is professor emeritus at Antioch University and author of The Nobel Peace Prize and the Laureates. He spoke to us from Yellow Springs, Ohio. How do the traditional conservative and liberal labels fit into the political landscape today? Historically, the standard left-right divide shaped American politics and helped us define ourselves. We were either liberals or conservatives and embraced the ideology of our chosen camp. The line in the sand was clear, and so were we like to think, in our political views. But things are different now, says tonight's guest, Arianna Huffington, and America needs a new path and new solutions. She says we've become two nations, one basking in unprecedented prosperity, the other left to choke on the dust of Wall Street's recently galloping bulls. Where do you stand in the map of American politics today? Where do you fit in? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Arianna Huffington. Good evening and welcome, Madam Huffington.
Thank you so much.
It's good to have you.
The bulls are not exactly galloping at the moment.
Well, recently, yeah, stumbling right now. Here in the studios with us, Arianna Huffington, and listeners, is our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, and welcome to the studio, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Arianna.
Hello, Jack. You and I go a long way back.
We do indeed.
Oh, another life.
So many lives. Arianna, Jack was sharing with me this afternoon how at one time you were called, I guess maybe in your Cambridge days, the most ambitious Greek since Icarus.
No, the most upwardly mobile.
Upwardly mobile. How about those singed feathers? We're smelling burning feathers tonight, folks.
Exactly. You can smell them all the way where you are, right?
Well, we all have our fall. Arianna Huffington, We are fascinated with how Bill Clinton, how the 90s boom, how the bust of the boom, how 9/11, how the war on terror are all shaking up the political parameters, the way Americans are thinking about our national political lives, our personal political lives. We've come to you because you made a great migration in the latter part of the 90s from conservative on the Newt Gingrich bandwagon to something far more liberal. I guess we want to look at that, but I guess the place to begin is, how do you see, in the wake of September 11th and everything that's come down the pike in the last few months and years, how do you see the map of American politics shifting?
Well, first of all, I see party loyalty being weaker than ever. And we have facts about that. We have the great increase in the registering of independents or decline to stay, depending on what state you are in. We also have an incredible sort of weakening in the party loyalty expressed, for example, here in California, when an enormous amount of Democrats are voting and supporting Dick Riordan, who is running for governor, partly because they're disgusted with Gray Davis, who's been nothing more than a sort of fundraising machine. and it's very hard to really know what he's passionate about. So people who admire what Rio Dandino in education, or frankly, who like his wife, who is a Democrat, who's done an enormous amount for disadvantaged children, are going with Reardon. Susan Estrich, who you may remember, ran the Michael Dukakis campaign, is now running Democrats for Reardon.
But here we see you having made a migration from conservative to liberal. Are you running against the tide, Arianna Huffington?
Well, no. First of all, I would not say I made a migration from conservative to liberal.
How would you describe it?
I made it a migration from conservative to radical. I am kind of questioning the status quo. I have by no means become a liberal Democrat. I mean, if by that you mean Dick Gephardt, or I don't know who you mean, because
we don't know either anymore.
I know, that's one of the problems. So the word liberal, I think, has certain connotations, and although there are many many things I would agree with, like the role of government, there are also many things that are still incredibly traditional within a liberal ideology, and my take on many issues is a lot more radical, is a lot more questioning of the roots of things. I mean, if you take education, for example, I think a lot of liberals would support the current public education system, which I think is rotten to the core. And I would like to see it shaken up, and I'm working with a group called Parents in Charge. Parentsincharge.org, for your listeners, would give them some information, that really wants to bring equity and choice to the public school system. This is just an example of how I would differ from the sort of traditional ideology.
But conservative to radical can mean so many things. I mean, John Birch was a radical. Jesse Helms might be described as a radical. What kind of radical are you?
I would say radical in the sense that the heart of what I believe, which frankly I believe even when I was a conservative, I just saw different ways to get there, mm-hmm. Is that we have become two nations, as I write about in How to Overthrow the Government. One nation has benefited tremendously from the prosperity of the 80s and the 90s. Another nation, even during the best of times, was left behind in terms of health care, education for their children, all the things that that the other nation has benefited from. The nation of those who are largely minorities, largely living in the inner cities, has not been part of those good times.
But do most Americans perceive this as a problem? Is it shaping the politics of Americans as they see or don't see two nations?
Not even remotely. And that's, I think, the problem. But the reason for that is that there aren't many visible champions. I mean, the Democratic Party that you would have thought would be the champion of those left behind has not been. I mean, we basically have Dick Gephardt and Tom Daschle endorsing, for example, a $15 billion bailout of the airline industry that did not even include fundamental protections for those who, the day after the bailout was passed, lost their jobs. Mm. I mean, that just gives you an idea of how far the two parties have really merged. You also have the fact that Tom Daschle's wife was a lobbyist for American Airlines. So, again, the revolving door of politicians' wives, politicians' staffers, then becoming champions for different special interests is really making Washington a place where the public interest cannot prevail.
The weave is very dense. Jack Beatty, Arianna Huffing describes herself as going from conservative to radical. Do you see her in line with a trans-American movement, or is this something unique to our guest tonight?
Well, I don't know. I think she raises to the 10th power of clarity something that a lot of people have been feeling, which is that the grid set up by the two parties no longer speak to the complexity of political emotion and understanding that people have, and that the idea that we're born either conservative babies or liberal babies is just not acceptable, especially to younger people who have an ideological eclecticism, who want to combine liberalism in cultural issues with a much more conservative approach to government and a much more active approach to the environment. And neither party really is speaking to the shift that's going on in the country.
Where are you in the shift? How would you even define it? Where are your politics today, and why? Whose line is making sense to you, if any line? Have you swooned into the muscular arms of George Bush? What do Democrats stand for anymore? And if you're a new Republican, what's that mean to you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Arianna Huffington about the new map of American politics. Where do you fall in it? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the new map of American politics and where you may fall in it. Our guest tonight is Arianna Huffington, political commentator, author most recently of How to Overthrow the Government. And this from a woman who not so long ago was on Newt Gingrich's bandwagon, but she says tonight she's made a journey from conservative to radical, not to liberal. That doesn't work for her anymore. How about you? Are you comfortable these days being labeled, thinking of yourself as a conservative, as a liberal? Does any of that make sense? Has 9/11 shaken up your self-image politically? Has the market bust shaken up the base of your republicanism or driven you ever stronger into a market perspective? Come on tonight with us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and let us know where you fall in the new map of American politics. Arianna Huffington, talk to us about how deeply you got into the conservative fold and what it was that popped you out of there.
Well, first of all, there were many issues on which I was never a conservative. Like, I was always pro-choice. I was always pro-gun control. I was always pro-gay rights. So the main journey for me has been from believing that the private sector could step up to the plate and solve a lot of the problems of poverty and the two nations problems that I described earlier.
You've written that you were seduced, fooled, blinded, and bamboozled. Was it by the promise of the market to take care of these issues, or was it Newt Gingrich's sterling personality?
By the promise of Newt Gingrich. You may remember his first speech when he became Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke of the fact, and I'm paraphrasing, that poverty is a much greater problem and a much more urgently needed problem in terms of where our attention should go than balancing the budget. I mean, that, of course, was a joke, given what he actually proceeded to do, which is cut Medicare in order to balance the budget.
Yeah.
But at the time, this was very much in line with what he had said to me in private conversations for the 2 years preceding his becoming the Speaker, when he actually got in touch with me after a speech I gave that was on C-SPAN that was entitled "Can Conservatives Have a Social Conscience?", in which I spoke of the need for conservatives to address these problems of poverty and inequalities. And he called me and he said, "I want you to come and speak to the Congressional Caucus, the Republican Congressional Caucus that was meeting in Princeton in retreat, and address that, because that's really what I want us to do. That's a priority for me." And, you know, he had no reason to say that. I mean, I didn't even have a column. I couldn't be of any use to him. And so I had no reason to disbelieve him. And so for me, it was just a gradual disillusionment. I mean, frankly, pretty fast. I mean, as I look at my columns from 1995, it only took a few months into the year before I started criticizing what Gingrich was doing.
And yet, Arianna Huffington, it wasn't only Newt Gingrich and the far right who wanted to believe in the 90s that markets could take care of an awful lot of what ailed America and the world. People still want to believe that. It's hard to give up on, given what we saw about the inefficiencies of government addressing many of these problems in earlier decades. Where do you stand on markets right now? What can we look to them for? We want to believe that they've got some strong positive power.
Well, definitely, we still believe that the free market is better than a command economy. But what we've learned, certainly very spectacularly with the collapse of Enron, is that markets have to be regulated, that we cannot assume that that the public interest will prevail through the unfettered working of Adam Smith's invisible hand. But I think one of the reasons why free markets are not working as well as they work in my textbooks when I was studying economics at Cambridge is because of this influence of money and on our politicians. I mean, basically, the public interest is up for sale. Public policy is not really determined by the free markets. We have hundreds of millions of dollars every year going to corporate welfare. We have, the bailout that I described a minute ago is certainly not a product of the free market. It's a product of massive lobbying and massive contributions by the airline industry to politicians of both parties. And that's really the tragedy, that this is not just a Republican problem. It's a very widespread problem of how there are no champions left for the public interest. I mean, take 9/11. Mm-hmm. Terrorism, counterterrorism, the need to protect the homeland was not really on the top of anybody's agenda before 9/11. I mean, it should have been. We had plenty of warnings. We had the Hart-Rodman report that was produced by Senators Hart and Warren Rodman. That's really very clearly prophesied what actually did happen, but they could not get anybody to listen to them. And frankly, they could not even get the media to pay attention. The New York Times did not even cover it.
Not a bit. Jack Beatty, you hear Arianna Huffington carving out a new kind of uncategorizable position here. She calls it radical. Where do you see what you hear from Arianna falling in the new map of American politics? Is she with the mainstream or somewhere else? Where's the wind blowing, Jack?
Well, there's a poll done for the Cook Political Report in late January of party identification, and it shows that since September 11th, before September 11th, the Democrats had a 9-point advantage, and now the Republicans have an 8-point. It's been a shift of 8 points to the Republicans. And this surge has come from non-working suburban moms. They're up 11% Republicans. Single moms up 10%. Low-income working mothers up 16 points to the Republicans. And then when you look at the data further, the groups that have gone to the Democrats or have gone only slightly to the Republicans are people with postgraduate degrees, Hispanics, people with incomes, this is to the Democrats,
okay,
above 100,000. And the one group that has come way over to, and of course, blacks and high income, highly educated men, they have swung to the Democrats. Well, that is the paradigm of the Democrats' Democratic problem. In 1948, Harry Truman, running as an incumbent president, running on a platform of national health insurance, among other things, ran against Tom Dewey. And at Andover Preparatory School in Massachusetts, they did a poll of the students.
The elite of the elite.
The elite of the elite. Dewey carried him 2-1. In 2000, Al Gore ran against a graduate, George W. Bush of Andover, and Al Gore carried, and Nader together carried the Andover student body by better than 2-1.
So the elites just shifted absolutely from Republican to Democrat.
Meanwhile, white men with high school educations, who were the heart of Harry Truman's party, went for the GOP by 23 points. You can't build a mass party, a party of the people. It's great to have highly educated people in your party, but that's not a big slice of the population. And the Democrats have this elite problem. And it, to someone like me, brought up in the other tradition, it is an incubus.
Arianna Huffington, what do you hear there? This is the tide running strong against the path you've taken. It's numbers going back to the Republican Party.
Hello?
Hello, Arianna, are you there?
Yes.
Just off of Jack, the numbers that Jack Beatty is citing here, showing a strong shift, especially post 9/11, to the Republican Party. What does that mean to you? You've gone the other way, but Americans, and as Jack says, especially kind of the middle class and below, going strongly to the Republican Party.
Well, I think that's understandable, given the fact that still protecting the homeland and the war on terror remains for people the priority, although the numbers are shifting, with the economy becoming more of a concern. So I think, again, I have to tell you that I have a raging campaign against polls. I think they are they so misinterpret what's going on. I mean, just the fact that, say, before on September 10th, terrorism was sort of nowhere to be seen in any poll in America, and suddenly on September 11th becomes the greatest priority.
Well, fair enough, but at the end of the day, it's polls in voting booths that determine who's in power.
Well, only because polls right now predict who is going to be in power by ignoring the fact that half of the electorate, half of the eligible voters do not bother to vote.
Fair enough.
I mean, that's another major reason why polls are so destructive to our political health, because you basically, everybody has given up at the moment on polling anybody but likely voters. So I don't know the demographic of the numbers that Jack has been citing, but I would be surprised if they include the whole universe. So do they, Jack, or are they just likely voters?
No, I think this is a random sample of adults.
Whether likely or unlikely.
Yeah, and I think the point is this is the kind of thing you expect after a crisis, a rally around the president. But I was only tying it back to the Andover example because, of course, it shows the Democrats' class problem. It is that the party is not now seen as the party of working Americans. And this is a terrible thing for a party whose identity is to be the party of working Americans.
Jack Beatty, Ariana, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's invite them in and see what they have to bring to this party. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think of your political choices today? What's driving your personal politics? Where are you headed? Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. So I have more of a comment. And what I wonder about when looking at conservatism versus liberalism is the issue of definition. It's like if you're a conservative, it's almost as if by definition your thinking is rather rigid as to a viewpoint, whereas liberalism by definition demands that you be open and flexible to alternative ideas and other people's viewpoints.
Well, now there's a thesis. Let's put it to Ariana Huffington. Ariana, you've experienced both sides now. Do you agree with Imran's suggestion that liberals are more flexible than conservatives?
Well, again, to return to the huge issue of education, that wouldn't be the case there because liberals tend to just defend the public education system as it exists today, even though, of course, many wealthy liberals have taken their kids out of the system. Mm-hmm. And they defend it with a kind of blindness and a sort of disregard of the incredible suffering it has caused to millions of disadvantaged children that have been trapped in dysfunctional schools for years. That certainly does not show any kind of flexibility.
How about that, Imran? Justify your suggestion that liberals are more flexible. Where do you see that?
Well, so I would say my response is more along the lines of looking how the nation has responded to 9/11, where people have automatically gone to the conservative side, which has been, you know, in other words, they want to be fed a way of thinking that, these people are bad, or that you're either with us or you're with against us. If you have dissent, then you're basically providing ammunition for the enemy. I mean, that type of conservative thinking is basically providing people with an easy answer in a way to think.
Well, we see where you're coming from. Let's put it to Ariana Huffington, because interestingly, of course, many liberals have also embraced the tough posture toward the world. Ariana Huffington, how do you see the 9/11 terrorist threat in particular affecting the sort of the body politic, the political thinking of Americans, including liberals?
Well, 9/11 looked at the beginning as though it was really going to affect things. Right now, it seems that we're in a kind of false lull of normality, partly engendered by the fact that George Bush kind of defined patriotic as returning to normal and going to Disneyland and going back to the mall.
Right.
So there is this incredible opportunity that has not been taken to appeal to the better angels of our natures and to ask Americans to care for those who are left out of our prosperity, to care for those who are unemployed without health insurance, for the million children, homeless children, the 11 million children without health insurance. But they're not at the forefront of our agenda. The State of the Union was really remarkable in the absence of these issues. And frankly, Dick Gephardt's response to the State of the Union was also remarkable in the fact that he did not put those issues at the top of the agenda.
John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Thanks. Yeah, I agree with Ariana that money governs, and particularly with the current president. I myself am an issue-oriented person. I'm probably more liberal, but environment and energy conservation, a strong defense, they're all important to me. What we have here is a major problem in that Bush's poll ratings are high because there's a great fog over what he's doing. I mean, what he's doing with the environment, what he's doing with tax cuts for the rich, what he's doing with with his energy policies.
Well, fair enough, but do you think the Republicans are really more money-driven than Democrats today?
Well, they're more I think ideologically or historically they're more inclined to give tax cuts to the rich, whether or not they are. I can't answer your question. Mm-hmm. I just know that there are more.
I think you're right that historically they were, but if you look at what's happening now, you don't have many Democrats saying, let's roll back the tax cut.
In fact, the leading Democrats are not saying that.
Yes, they're very deliberately saying no.
They're afraid to.
They're afraid to, exactly. And
do you think that fear is well-placed, Arianna Huffington, or are they reading old tea leaves here?
No, I think they're reading old tea leaves and new polls. But it's also like a different different definition of leadership. I'm doing a book on leadership at the moment, and I'm looking at leaders who really are followers, which is what most of our leaders are today, and leaders who are going out there and creating a new consensus. All the major political leaders from Abraham Lincoln down did not read the polls and say, oh, you know, people seem to be okay with slavery. You know, even when Lincoln signed the Emancipation Declaration, it was a very unpopular document. I'm sure if he had Dick Morris in the White House, he would have been told, you know, don't sign the Emancipation Declaration. Why don't you sign something that everybody's in favor of, like Secretary's Day?
It's kind of hard to picture Abraham Lincoln and Dick Morris deep in conversation. Jack Beattie, how about our caller, John? And thank you for your call, John. How about his point about Bush behind a fog of war? Do you see that?
Well, you know, the Bush tax stimulus plan involved lavish tax cuts. Now it's dead in the Senate, thank heaven. But the plan involved lavish tax cuts for businesses and the rich. And when this was put before focus groups, when the actual plan of the House Republicans and the president were put before focus groups, people refused to believe it. Now, that tells you there's a gap. The public doesn't really see what John sees, and what I think is really a fair estimate of Mr. Bush. He is a corporate man. He believes that, you know, that his party is the party of the big corporations. Now, Enron is an embarrassment for him precisely for that reason. And he's had a kind of straddle. He's a compassionate conservative, but thus far the compassion has been a rhetorical trope, and the conservatism has been tax cuts for the rich, depredations against the environment if polluters and corporate interests want it, and that's the fog of war is hiding that. That was beginning to become clear to people before September 11th when the Democrats had that 7-point lead.
Arianna Huffington, we just got half a minute, but do you go along with Jack Beattie's analysis of the Bush presidency here?
Yes, absolutely. I think Jack is absolutely right. That before September 11th, I mean, we had an enormous backlash against Bush and the environment, especially. We had a group called Republicans for the Environment attacking Bush. So it wasn't just liberals and Democrats. It was also moderate Republicans that were appalled by the way that the administration was willing to sacrifice the environment.
Republicans, what do you say? Does your party have it right today? Are you happy in the strong arms of the war leader, President George W. Bush? Liberals, where are your leading lights? And for all of us, what are the personal politics of this new map of America emerging after the 90s, emerging after the boom, emerging after September 11th? We're talking tonight with Arianna Huffington, author most recently of How to Overthrow the Government, but not so long ago in Newt Gingrich's camp, and our own news analyst, Jack Beattie. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the new map of American politics with political traveler and commentator Arianna Huffington, political commentator, syndicated columnist, author most recently of How to Overthrow the Government, once in Newt Gingrich's camp, now defining herself as a radical, a little bit of liberal, a little bit of something else. Caller before the break said President Bush is operating behind a fog. Maybe there's a fog over all of American politics right now, trying to figure out where it's headed. What about you personally? What's driving your personal politics? Where are they headed? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
We're well, thanks.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
I've probably made an opposite migration, or as Ms. Huffington has described, from sort of a liberal now in search of more radical solutions. But I agree with everybody that people are definitely in a fog. I remember at the time of the repealing the estate tax, I heard a statistic, and I don't think I'm exaggerating it, that 80% of the American people believe they were in the top 20% of income distribution.
Ain't that America?
And so the people have been bamboozled. But I think that what people are really looking for is a very even-handed way of getting everybody into the benefits of capitalism. And one thing that the Republicans have never addressed is that capitalism is a hugely successful engine for creating wealth, but it's not very good at letting other people into the game. And there are these ideas out there now, I don't know if people are hearing more and more of them, about these stakeholder ideas of getting people actually getting government to give capital to people to get them into the game.
Is this the
Bruce Ackerman of Yale did a book on this, the stakeholder society?
Well, when you turn 18, you get $18,000 from the government. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, David?
I think more like you turn 25, you get a $2,000 fund when you're born. It's attached to your Social Security number, mm-hmm. and then at some point in your young adulthood, you become vested in that. And you get a chance to do something. You get a chance to get into the game. I mean, I'm a perfect example. I came from a very modest background, was privileged to go to private schools and to Ivy League schools on scholarships. It took me 20 years to put together a down payment for a house. And I think a lot of people are in that situation.
David, let's turn that to Arianna Huffington. Arianna, what do you hear there? Do you think David's onto something, that for capitalism to close the big gap you've observed and written about, we have to actively promote stakeholding?
Well, I think we first of all have to actively promote a decent education for all children. I think that's where capitalism has really dropped the ball more than anywhere else. I mean, right now, education is so incredibly unequal. Remember, we were all worried about segregation, whereas Jonathan Coswell himself has said, schools right now in the South Bronx that he's written about are more segregated than they were in the most benighted hour in Mississippi.
But take that as an example. You're not looking to public schools to fill that gap.
Yeah, I am. I'm actually looking to redefining public education so that public education means that the government pays for it, not that the government provides it. I mean, when we talk about a single-payer health care system, for example, nobody's suggesting that the government should provide the health care. I mean, it's kind of unprecedented, if you think of it, that we should expect the government not just to pay for it for education, but to provide it.
So you would put a check in the family pocket for each child and let them spend it where they will?
I'm not in favor of vouchers, because vouchers are really not a real solution, because they're only giving a percentage of the cost of a child's education, and with a percentage of the cost, you can never really increase the quality of good schools. And I don't know about the entire country, but here in California that I have studied carefully, you know, the overcrowding is horrendous. I mean, we need 85 new schools in L.A. alone just to deal with the students at the moment. So if you give the entire amount to the parents, and of course not directly to the parents because they're also dysfunctional parents, but for them to assign to an accredited school of their choice, the school would have to be accredited. Therefore, the government would have the opportunity to disqualify any school that does not meet civil rights, discrimination, separation of church and state.
But at heart, you're putting markets to work in a new way here. I mean, it's markets in that people are making choices.
But it's also equitable, because I would take the per pupil funding that would go to the parents would be equalized between urban and suburban districts, and it would be means tested. So that money could not come to me. I have my kids in private school, so it would not be a subsidy for me. It would only go to parents who cannot afford private schools, which I know is not necessarily fair for middle-class parents, but right now we have a major crisis when it comes to low-income parents, and what the caller is saying is very legitimate. I mean, we have to
But the caller said he had a great education and still couldn't cross the chasm. Getting into that business of helping him across with a stakeholder grant from the government, that would be an enormous step. That would be radical. Is that your kind of radicalism, Arianna Huffington?
No, that's not my kind of radicalism. I'll tell you why. Because I believe that if we actually can guarantee a good education for all children, we would change the dynamic of this country very dramatically. First of all, we would reduce the numbers of people in jail. I mean, that's the major crisis at the moment. We have 2 million people in jail. And there's a very direct correlation between illiteracy, lack of education, which also means lack of an ability to get and hold down a job, and being basically on a criminal track. So what we're doing now, especially with the huge numbers of dropouts, mm-hmm. is we are condemning our children. We are condemning especially minority and low-income children to a life in jail. And that's something which is such a major crisis that I find it amazing that both parties have basically endorsed this ludicrous education bill, which is going to do nothing to change all that.
Ariane Huffington, we get that picture. We've just got a few seconds left with you. But how, if you're correct in your analysis, how do you muster a political majority to address that?
Well, I mean, what we are doing with Parents in Charge is to organize low-income parents. We're going to be launching a media campaign to try and get people to think outside the box about what public education is. I welcome your listeners to go visit parentsincharge.org. And basically, there is no alternative to organizing, educating, and basically hoping that the level of outrage will reach such a point that people will be willing to act.
Ariane Huffington, radical, looking for a new level of outrage. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we hope we can catch up with you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Ariane Huffington is political commentator and syndicated columnist, author most recently of How to Overthrow the Government. You can read more of her writings on her website, arianaonline.com. That's A-R-I-A-N-N-A, online. Jack Beatty, do you hear a prescription there? Do you see the map emerging of politics in this country today?
Well, you know, Ariana talked about the two nations, and it's not just, of course, the poor. It's middle-class people who have struggled for the last 25 and 30 years. And one of the things that's happened in that period of time is that voting has gone down since 1960, almost 20 points. There's a theorist called Walter Dean Burnham who says the missing element in our electorate, Britain's electorate votes at 30% more and Europeans generally at 20-30%, the missing electorate are people who would be social democrats in Europe. That is to say, they're voting for parties that offer them something, that give them something, for which with which they can identify their interest. Now,
but it seems like about 5 minutes ago we prided ourselves on not being social democrats. That was the pride of the 90s.
It wasn't my pride.
Well, Eurosclerosis in America riding high.
Oh, sure I am. But David, I think, gave us an idea, and I hope we can do a whole show on it, stakeholding. Bruce Ackerman at Yale has a whole idea about how our whole emphasis on Social Security is missing the dynamic. People need the money when they're young. And stakeholding would be a way to do that and would help, I think, to deal with this two-nation problem in a way I'm afraid that education can't.
Might be a way. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. They're removing their shoes, they're being frisked, they're having their briefcases and purses pawed by perfect strangers. A lot has changed for America's air travelers since the hijackings of September 11th and the alleged shoe bombing attempt by Richard Reed. In this radio diary, Meghna Chakrabarty, an intern here at On Point, talks about recent airport experiences as a person with brown skin.
If, in the throes of my tortured adolescence, I ever once complained that boys didn't pay enough attention to me, then I take it all back. These days, I get a lot of special attention, and none more than when I try to get on board an airplane. I've been asked to pull off my bangles, remove my shoes, take off my belt, all when passing through airport security. Most of this comes after I've been given the once-over by an exhausted-looking member of the security staff, who examines my brown skin and asks, "So, when did you become a U.S. citizen?" I can only assume that everyone else gets asked the same question. But it's obvious that not everyone else gets the special attention that I've come to look forward to. I imagine that I set off all sorts of warning signs when I pass through the metal detector. I'm brown, I get nervous easily around big guns, and I have big hair. Inevitably, another security guard intercepts me before I have the chance to retrieve my jacket from the X-ray machine and shouts, "Random!" The new code word for body check on shifty-looking brown person. He then leads me to a nice-looking lady wearing latex gloves. I should mention something about my hair here. It really is big, It's unruly and curly and tends to go every which way at once. The last time I was at Logan Airport, I had just washed my hair, and it was in particularly energetic form. The lady who searched me, she was brown too, probably from the Dominican Republic, looked up at my swirling curls with awe. She said, "I need to check. May I touch your hair?" "You know what?" I said to her. "You're the first woman ever to ask me that." As she massaged my scalp, I glanced at the other people who were receiving special attention. They were brown, and the people searching them were brown, all of various continental extraction. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's a conspiracy afoot to set coffee-colored people against themselves. This isn't a Buffalo Soldiers or Gurkha Rifles sort of thing. And I don't know if airport authorities have resorted to racial profiling. I've seen white people get special attention, too. But there's something decidedly unsettling about the not-random, random search. My recent travels have taken me to India, Nepal, Germany, and England, four nations that have had to face terror for a lot longer than America has. Everywhere I went, from Frankfurt to Bombay, airport security has been beefed up. But there's a marked difference in airport security overseas. First of all, there's more of it. In India, I was searched four times before getting on an airplane. But second, they're much more democratic about it. International airport authorities believe that anyone can be a terrorist, everyone is suspicious, and so everybody gets searched. Knowing that we'll all get frisked engenders a sense of solidarity amongst the passengers, and so no one seems to mind. It's an e pluribus unum take on airport security. Just strange that it's found so often outside the United States. Back here at home, I try to take all the special attention in stride. It helps keep the experience from venturing too far into the absurd. But being brown and getting searched is just so depressingly retrospective. Yes, so the hijackers and the shoe bomber were all brown. But I can't imagine that it takes a vast governmental study to realize that those who would wish to terrorize Americans come in as many shapes and colors as Americans do themselves. That realization will come someday. Until then, I can't complain that in the name of national security, my Latina compatriot felt my hair and wondered just how I got such bounce and shine into my galactic black tresses. She was just doing her job. But if she hadn't, I can see the headlines now. Hair scare at Logan! International terminal evacuated when big-haired woman is seen removing pen from scalp. Airport authorities claim a grenade may have been hidden in passenger's long locks. "It gave me the fright of my life," said one delayed traveler. But she wasn't a hair bomber. It turned out to be just a bobby pin. However, all those split ends she had, now they were suspicious.
Meghna Chakrabarty lives in Brookline, Massachusetts. You go, Meghna. Listeners, we want your stories on our program. Radio diaries start with an email or a letter from you. In just a moment, I'll give you the address, but first, some guidelines. These diaries start out as essays that are usually 600 to 800 words long. The subjects can run the gamut. How has your life been affected by the war on terror, or the Enron scandal, or the flagging economy? What music have you found solace in? How is your experience as a soldier, as a parent, an immigrant, an expatriate, a doctor, a cabbie, a teenager, coloring your interpretation of what you read in the paper or hear on the radio? Share your story with us now. The address. Send your essays and your ideas by email to onpoint@wbur.org or by U.S. mail to onpoint, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. That's On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBUR.